evening, Los Angeles, and welcome to your April 13th installment of K-Chung Radio Zone, The Talking Show.
Hey, LA. Hey, Chinatown. Thanks for joining us tonight. We hope you're all tuned in, dialed in, snuggled up in your beds probably for another episode of The Talking Show with Nicholas Miller and...
I'm Steve Cato.
We'd like to start by saying happy birthday to our eternal leader.
Solomon Bothwell?
No, our eternal leader, Kim Il-sung. It is his 103rd
birthday. Oh, this is the great leaders.
Yeah, he's...
Praise Solomon.
He died in the 90s, but is still alive, leading this great universe.
Praise Solomon.
Into the next thousands of years.
Long may he run in the name of Solomon Bothwell.
You know, I hear that the North Korean society has not allowed too many parties, but on our eternal leader's birthday, they all get off work and they get to party and sing super hard.
What songs do they sing?
I don't know. I've, you know, never made it over there.
Fair. Yeah, I suppose it's different than just going to North Korea Town, which is, you know, just around Beverly Street or something like that.
That's basically where you live, right?
I live in North Korea Town.
Excellent. They have good donuts up there.
They have good donuts in North Korea Town. It's true. I was thinking about another, another spectacle full of pomp and non-representational government that was on recently. The season premiere of Game of Thrones. Yeah, that aired this week. Did you watch that?
Yeah, I watched it on Tuesday.
Uh-huh.
Let's see. You know,
did you check out the torrent with the entire first four leaked episodes?
No, I didn't.
So you can binge watch and then get a month ahead, and at which point you're basically screwed.
You know, something weird happened to me. Let's see. I think I've experienced Game of Thrones in the last year in LA. But when I was spending my weekends in Marfa for the last 5 years, I was watching...
Wait, you lived in Marfa for the last 5 years?
Just for the weekends. You know, I'd fly back for the talking show.
Right, yeah.
We've talked about this. Yeah.
Just clearing it up for the infrequent listeners.
Yeah, of course. We don't want to throw them into a state of utter confusion.
It's hard.
But I watched much more TV then, and then transitioning to full-time LA, I've kind of phased out of television for some reason. And so I was streaming Game of Thrones on Monday night, and I fully fell asleep in the middle.
Really?
Yeah, I just like, you know...
Just not able to cope.
Whatever gets you excited, your parasympathetic or sympathetic nervous system, whichever of the two, just wasn't working. Yeah, I was like, oh, there's Tyrion. Meh.
You know, I mean... I think this season, as with last season too, they're a bit of a snoozer.
The dragons seem pissed.
Yeah.
It's like when my cat gets locked in the bathroom.
I was thinking the same thing, actually. I'm so mad at you. Yeah, we left the cat in the, we have like a cat door, mm-hmm. and there's a sort of staircase that goes downstairs. And it's like a little enclosed staircase that the cat can hang out in and watch squirrels from and stuff like that. And, we locked the cat in there once for a whole day by accident, and boy, was that cat pissed.
Wow.
Yeah. Dragon style.
Yeah, dragon style. Last time I locked my cat in the house on accident for a long time, she just threw up on the couch.
Teach you a lesson.
Yeah, that's what she does. She also threw up on the couch and then also spewed across my Library of Congress collection of Wallace Stevens poems.
Oh, shit.
And my friend Christopher Carleton's poems.
No.
I thought it was a compliment to Chris.
Yeah, maybe.
Put him in good company.
He's with Wallace Stevens, I suppose. It is sort of like a strange protest to strike.
Right. You know, if somebody's going to hate my work, at least, you know, lump me in a great category.
Yeah, fair enough. That's true. So you weren't that impressed by the season opener of GOT.
Let's see what happened. I'm eagerly awaiting Cersei's death. I don't know when that'll happen, but I could tell it's gonna happen. There's a prophecy.
Yeah, right. It's true.
I'm glad that Tyrion's still alive. You know, the endings are always great. And what's his name shooting the guy in the heart as he's burning alive?
Yeah, Jon Snow shooting Mace. Yeah.
I found myself in the last 24 hours wondering many times what will happen to Jon Snow since he...
Well, I've binge watched the next couple episodes, so I can tell you right now, but I won't.
He's such a good guy, and good guys in that show and the world we live in don't seem to get very far.
It's true. You know, I was in my job as a contemporary artist, I was assembling some repetitive assembly work that required only sort of manual focus, and it's the kind of thing that you do put on TV and do while you stream a bunch of TV. So I started streaming the first season of Game of Thrones.
Oh, okay.
And watching it from the beginning, and it's amazing how much stuff I had missed.
Mm-hmm.
And how much stuff they work out in advance. Like they, characters who appear only for like 1 second in the first season come back by the third season or something that are major characters. And I felt like they had maybe just sort of appeared.
Right.
But they had been sort of laying the groundwork for some of these characters for a very, very, very long time. And I was impressed, I have to say.
Well, they do have the privilege of knowing the entire story from the beginning.
That's true, but I mean, it's just TV.
Does the, you know, like the old crank who wrote the story, wrote the novels, does he actually write the music? This is a rumor I've heard.
Well, you know, I saw a Wikipedia factoid about Game of Thrones that,
you mean you saw truth?
I saw a factoid that the composer's an Indian guy, or the name of the composer at least implies that he's of South Asian descent.
Okay.
And the story I heard was that the theme music was composed only 2 weeks before the first episode aired.
Wow. The music has gotten more complex for sure. And yeah. I definitely...
Well, the budget has expanded drastically. The show is now the most expensive show on television.
Awesome. And, you know, I'm beginning to recognize that each house has its own theme. And
yeah, right.
Those kinds of things. I like the what's her name? You know, she hails to the Lord of Light.
The red
sexy
priestess.
Redheaded priestess.
Yeah, for Stannis Baratheon.
Yeah. She has a great song.
What's her song go like?
What song? Supposedly, musical memory is the most readily available kind of memory, but I can't recall that one.
Hmm. Maybe it's your synesthesia kicking in. Maybe you should make me the smell of that song.
Okay, there it is.
I'm having a hard time placing it, actually. You should try again.
Well, you know, speaking of hermetic cranks who write long novels, I think it's maybe time to introduce our guest for tonight. What do you say, Steve?
I don't know. He doesn't look like he wants to go on. He looks...
He kind of looks horribly disfigured, to be honest.
Maybe that's just how his face looks. I'm afraid I'm not. He's a friend of yours, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
As much as one can be a friend with this person.
Well, that's rather harsh. He hasn't even gotten on the radio yet.
He just, you know, you can only go over to his place so many times.
Right.
And see all those cats.
Shut-ins, yeah.
Yeah,
it's tough. To be fair, the talking show is aired at the hour that is most friendly to weird shut-ins.
The witching hour.
And, so it was bound to happen that one warlock or another would grace our mantle with his talking voice.
Excellent. Well, with that, we will warmly introduce our shut-in of the week, Octavius Sealed of the Sealed Library.
He's right here in the studio. He's using his space frame walker to come right over here. Hold on.
Good evening, Los Angeles. Good evening, Chinatown. I have a few things from the Sealed Library that I'd like to read for you. The first was originally written in English in the middle of the 17th century by Sir Thomas Browne. Fittingly, this was written for people about ready to sleep. Are you already sleeping? An evening prayer. Thou whose nature cannot sleep, on my temples sentry keep. Guard me against those watchful foes whose eyes open whilst mine close. Let no dreams my head infest, but such as Jacob's temples blessed. While I do rest, my soul advance, make me to sleep a holy trance. The next text I have for you, listeners, is a text called The Mask by Roger Caillois. Written in the winter of 1957, this text was translated by one of our more obscure fellows, a gentleman by the name of Jeffrey Stuker. The Mask. Here I offer some reflections and several facts potentially useful for phenomenology of the mask. Needless to say, these hypotheses are of an adventurous character. With them I offer nothing less than an origin to the universal use of the mask by people, which goes back beyond this species to the insects who still wear it. 1. The importance of the mask. All humanity wears or has worn a mask. This enigmatic accessory without useful end is more widespread than the lever, the bow, the harpoon, or the plow. Some peoples were entirely ignorant of more humble or more precious tools, yet they knew of the mask. Some civilizations, among them the most remarkable, have prospered without the idea of the wheel, or worse, without knowing how to use it. Yet they were familiar with the mask. Man in general, abstract and hypothetical man, from the first eras and the first cultures, could not have embodied more accurately, more appropriately, Descartes' saying, "I advance masked." There is not a tool, an invention, a belief, a custom, or an institution which brings about the unity of humanity to the same degree accomplished by the wearing of the mask. The mask remains mysterious. What are the reasons that have driven people to cover their faces with a second visage, instrument of metamorphosis and ecstasy, of possession by the gods, instrument as well of intimidation and political power? All of ethnology is filled with masks, and with the vertigo, the trances, the hypnoses, and the panics that are its nearly inevitable consequences. Here I chance my first sprawling hypothesis. A people enters history and civilization the moment they reject the mask, when they repudiate it as an instrument of individual or collective panic, once they consign it to an institutional function. Even reduced to a simple carnival accessory or mundane festivity, it disquiets and fascinates. Its power of seduction has been completely appropriated, yet it does not disappear. I will come back to this. For the moment, though, I would like only to underline that the problem of the mask is neither episodic nor local. It affects the entire species. 2. People and insects. Here I come to a second wild hypothesis, the family resemblance between insects and people. For a while now, I have tried to demonstrate how the behavior of the one corresponds to the mythologies of the other. I brought conduct and fiction, instinct and phantasm, face to face. There's more to it, though. The problem of a society that leads to castes, war, colonization, and slavery. The problem of language and that of geometry, for bees. That of drugs and of voluntary intoxication, death drives, and vices, for ants. Always with the same opposition between automatism and liberty, between fixity, immutable repetition and invention, the fluidity of history. On one side, the inscription of the body, valid for thousands of centuries, and beyond that, the perfection of the organ, the antennae, the pupae, the faceted eyes, without even mentioning the quasi-somnambulistic infallibility of instinct. On the other side, the capacity to create crude and clumsy tools, external, insufficient weapons, external, and cumbersome clothing, which, unlike the carapaces and fleeces, does not form part of the body, like the armors or fur coats that cannot be taken off. Then come machines for fabricating clothes, weapons, or tools, followed by complex machines for fabricating the more simple machines. This faculty, capable of developing itself without end, implies the blind search for error and the rectification of error. It inaugurates, at the same time, decisive freedom. It presupposes an imprecise and ambiguous language that encourages nonsense, not a system of unequivocal signals, with its limited code of swarming and inexorable choreographies that people wrongly call the language of bees. Due to a radical misrecognition of the confused nature of language and the unquestionable practical similarities. This sinister or happy fall from grace has as its precondition still class conflict in society, religious wars with hate and fanaticism, revindications, revolts, and revolutions, not an unalterable order, not a perfect economy and physiology corroborating or dictating the social regime. It supports mathematical speculations which invent hyperspaces, abstract volumes, unimaginable, if not inconceivable, amusements in the refined free play of arbitrary signs. Not the implacable and exclusively hexagonal geometry of the honeycomb. I stop myself here, but the analogies abound. They follow any customary contrast, even the strict parallelism of a term-for-term opposition. The insect created in itself, thus at the level of the species, man outside of himself, thus at the level of the individual. 3. Fulgora latinaria. Certain insects, such as the Siphonia, the Heterontus, and the Sphongosporus, grow giant shades above them like torturous umbrellas, superstructures, and disconcerting forms. These branching, encumbering appendages have no apparent utility. They are purely ornamental, airy excrescences, which bifurcate spontaneously in a granular and absurd fashion, completely in the service of equilibrium and symmetry. They cannot but recall the angular and skillfully corrected crossouts in Tagore's manuscripts, the indentations in the most exceptionally crafted medieval keys, and the zigzagging sinuosities of Scythian animal art. More than anything, they resemble the scaffolding mounted atop certain oceanic and American ceremonial masks. Additionally, very large scarabs grow certain pointy appendages, which is why some of them have been named after the rhinoceros or the nasicorn. The lucan lumbers along with a big articulated deer antler, which would function like a jaw, except it has no function. Similarly, the sorcerer's masks are frequently adorned with horns and antlers. I will raise no argument against it. There is a type of hemiptera named fulgora that the dictionary timorously defines as luminous insects from hot countries. The naturalists make a distinction between, or rather would have distinguished in the year 10 of the French Revolution, since classifications are ephemeral, the lantern holder fulgora from Brazil and Guyana, the candle holder fulgora from China, the darkened fulgora from Guinea, the phosphorescent fulgora, and the nycoloptic fulgora from Suriname, the gleaming fulgora from Cayenne, and finally the European fulgora from Mediterranean Italy and from Sicily. With the exception of the last one, which is strictly geographic, each of these adjectives allude to the presumed relation between these insects and light. This conclusion is arrived at through a deeply rooted belief about the dominant fulgora, the Fulgora latinaria, or lanternfly. In the 18th century, Maria Sibylla Marianne attributed to it the legend of radiating such a considerable light that she could read a newspaper by its brightness. The head of this variety of fulgora extends before it as an empty protuberance, nearly as voluminous as its body. You can imagine that the insect got its name from a lantern, yet we have to get over that, because the fulgora is not luminous. It's the emptiness in the protuberance that creates doubts. The lantern lacks a candle. Such naivete is no longer accepted. However, some scientists would concede that the protuberance has a faint luminosity. It glows with infrared rays produced by photogenic bacteria. In any case, there was no question of the intense light which, according to Maria Sibylla Marianne, allowed her easily to read a book similar in typeface to that of the Gazette d'Alente. An art critic, a perspicuous one in my opinion, has remarked that Mona Lisa's enigmatic smile does not come from the rendering of her lips, but the fact that she was painted perfectly depilated, without lashes or eyebrows. By a sort of transference, it's the smile that attracts attention. I believe that this observation is applicable quite generally. When something surprises us, we are led to discover the cause not in the true reason, which we close our eyes to, but in a trait that preconception has designated in advance, or that, for all sorts of reasons, we are expected to notice. The bizarreness of the fulgora is its presumed phosphorescence. Shocked by the fulgora, I suppose that Maria Sibylla Marianne spontaneously attributed to it the surprising feature of lightning bugs. The cephalic protuberance of the fulgora portrays the head of an alligator with perfect precision. On it, a false jaw is drawn, and an enormous arc protects the semblance of a globular eye. Behind this simultaneously dwarfish and giant face, on which each of the traits have been perfectly modeled, but nearly caricatured, one discovers with great effort two shining black, almost microscopic dots, the eyes. The hollow pocket is superfluous. One should even think of it as a form of mimicry. A hemiptera that lives on trees, flying from branch to branch, decked out with the head of a centimeter and a half long reptile? To frighten whom? What enemy of the fulgora could be frightened by a real crocodile and at the same time fear its miniaturization to such a small scale? Nothing is more absurd. Outside of this, the fulgora truly is a mimetic insect. Its upper wings are covered with camouflage, drawn and tinted so as to allow them to blend with the trunk of the semiruba tree, which this insect takes to by preference. From their abdomen, large waxy fleeces emerge, rendering them invisible among the mosses, lichens, and irregularities of the bark. If they take such care to dissimulate, why at the same time attract attention with a monstrous mask? I anticipate two responses to this question. The first consists of denying the fact of the frontal protuberance of the fulcora, saying it truly resembles the head of a crocodile. The complacency of the human imagination would thus have brought about a simple illusion. Some details, without a doubt strange, would have encouraged the mania of interpretation, but the purely fortuitous coming together here objectively would represent nothing. But now I bring everyone's attention back to the photograph of the fulgora. It seems to me that anthropomorphism does in fact play a considerable role. The elements of the resemblance are as such only by virtue of the reciprocal distribution. Isolated or differently arranged, someone would only be fantasizing, recognizing eyes or teeth there, the way we amuse ourselves by discovering forms in clouds. But in this particular case, everything fits and comes together like the pieces of a puzzle. I agree that the resemblance is scandalous, but I can no longer, just to avoid a scandal, deny the evidence. I arrive at the second response. Resting under the dissimulation of the mimetic wings, large ocelli round out the lower wings of the fulgora. Now we know that the purpose of the ocelli of the sphinx moth and of the caterpillar serve to stupefy their prey or adversary. The insect unmasks them as its body vibrates convulsively. Certain insects display circles, simulacra of enormous eyes. They use them to fascinate their eventual predator or victim because imposed and prolonged contemplation of a fixed circle provokes paralysis and hypnosis. This display, used by the weak to overpower the strong, or of the slow to immobilize the quick, is accomplished by a frenzy, the rhythm of which possesses a spellbinding power. People and animals are equally susceptible to these purely optical and rhythmic effects. On one side, there are insects whose dissimulating upper wings blend them with their surroundings, who then, in a spasmodic tremor, suddenly reveal enormous circles, the lifelike colors of which stand in for a sort of absence, or at least a neutral presence, difficult to discern. On the other side, masked people, who no longer appear as people, creeping up and conducting themselves as ferocious animals or demons, specters emerging from another world. They feel possessed by strange and sovereign forces. Their gestures and their cries are dictated by the being who possesses them or whom they incarnate. Thus transformed, they terrify and haunt the duped people who cannot identify them and lose all power to defend themselves and to react. In their panic, they are not capable of recognizing the obvious truth, the presence of the person behind the apparition. If not for the ocelli, I would doubtly hesitate, and I myself could adhere to the thesis, unsatisfying as it is, of a caprice of human nature. But the perfectly judicious use of the ocelli is there as well. There is the foe and the implementation of the foe. The insect behaves like a person, wearing a mask and knowing how to use it. From this point, I have decided no longer to believe in chance and convergence. I distance myself from the scientists to whom those ocelli and other astonishing anomalies appear as simple ornaments. As I can see, this word only constitutes a weak metaphor compared to that of the mask, which I adopt here by preference. Once again, it's necessary to restate the opposition between the world of insects and that of people. The immobile mask, sculpted forever in the morphology of the species, and the fragile simulacrum, exterior and mobile, with which the officiant covers his face in the act of deception. But the intended effect is the same, and the means of obtaining it symmetrical. The protuberance of the fulgora is a mask. From this point on, it is less important that it portrays or does not portray an alligator's head. A mask is not made to faithfully represent another face. It is not designed, it is not destined to bring change, but to terrify. I would like to see entomologists research the mask of the fulgora to know if it really is terrifying, if it truly frightens the animals it would be in the interest of the fulgora to frighten. Put differently, if this insect makes use of its mask to complete the effect of its ocelli. 4. Reasons behind the mask's destitution. Humankind has relinquished its claim on the mask. The sacrifice is considerable when we recall that the mask remained for a long time the sign of superiority par excellence. In primitive societies, it was always a question of whether to be masked and to inspire fear, or not to be and to feel fear. Or, in a more complex organization, to fear a few and to inspire fear in others, according to the degree of initiation. To be instructed in the mystery of a more secret mask is to pass on to a higher level, but this means learning that the frightening supernatural apparition is but a man disguised, a man who masks himself to terrify the unholy or those initiated at a lower level. The decline of the mask is certainly a problem worth considering. How and for what reason has humankind been led to renounce it? The question does not appear to have concerned ethnographers. As such, it is of extreme importance. I advance the following hypothesis, which excludes nothing. On the contrary, it calls on the existence of multiple diverse and incompatible strains of thought corresponding to each culture and particular situation, and as such, it proposes a mechanism common to each. The mask's system of initiation only functions if there is a constant overlap between the revelation of the secret of the mask and, in turn, the right to use it to terrify the uninitiated and to access the divinatory trance. In this way, knowledge and use are directly linked. Only one who knows the true nature of the mask and of the masked can put on appearances convincingly. Above all, it is important to submit oneself to a leader, or at least to submit oneself to the same degree. Above all, it is impossible to submit oneself to a leader, or at least submit oneself to the same degree, with the same feeling of sacred panic, if one knows that he is simply wearing a disguise. This is practically impossible to ignore, or in any case, to ignore for a long time. At this point, a permanent fissure emerges in the system, which must defend itself against the curiosity of the uninitiated by a complete series of prohibitions and punishments, those latter being the most real. In fact, only death is effective against a kept secret. Because of this, the mechanism, in spite of seeming to prove itself by bringing about ecstasy and possession, remains fragile. At all times, it must defend itself against accidental discovery, indiscreet questions, hypotheses, or explanations. Inevitably, the fabrication of masks and the wearing of disguises, without losing their sacred character as such, could not preserve themselves through the threat of death forever. By unnoticed transformations, they become mere liturgical ornaments, ceremonial accessories for dance or theater. 5. The ultimate fascination. Perhaps the most recent attempt at political domination by the mask was that of Hakim al-Mukhanna, the veiled prophet of Khorasan, who, during the final years of the 8th century, from 160 to 163 of the Hegira, held the armies of Caliph in check. Over his face he wore a green mask. According to some, it was made of gold, which he never removed. He claimed to be God, stating that he covered his face because no mortal could behold him without going blind. His adversaries violently contested his pretensions, with good reason. The chroniclers, it is true, all the historiographers of the caliph, write that he acted in this way because he was bald, one-eyed, and repulsively ugly. His disciples summoned him to prove that what he claimed was true, insisting upon seeing his face. When some of them were actually burned, when he revealed it to them, the others were convinced. The official history explains the miracle, uncovering or inventing the stratagem. Here is the account of the episode as it is found in one of the oldest sources. 50,000 of Al-Mukanna's soldiers protested at the door of the castle demanding to see him. They implored and insisted, saying they would not budge until they saw the face of their god. Al-Mukanna had a servant called Hajib, to whom he said, "Go tell my creatures Moses asked to let him see my face, but I did not agree to show him because he would not have been able to bear my gaze. And if someone were to see me, he would die instantly." But the soldiers continued to implore him. Al-Mukanna then told them, "Return on the appointed day and I will show you my face." Then, to the 100 women whom he kept with him in the castle, in addition to his servant Hajib, and these were largely the daughters of peasants from Sogd, Kesh, and Nakhshab, he gave the order to take a mirror up to the roof of the castle. He showed them how to hold the mirrors in such a manner that when one faced the other, the surfaces all reflected the most intense sunlight. At this point, the men had gathered again. When the sun reflected upon the mirrors, the area and all of its surroundings were submerged in this light. He then said to his servant, "Say to my creatures, here is your God presenting himself to you. Behold him, behold him." The men were terrified. They prostrated themselves. Following this, Al-Mukanna supported his divinity with additional illusions. Out of a pit in Nakhshab, he erected a luminous entity resembling a moon, the light of which shined for several miles during a period of 2 months. One text even describes this entity returning into the pit after having risen to a certain height. However, the ancient chroniclers remain mute on the mechanics of this miracle and on the nature of its luminous globe, which, perhaps, was an ancestor, modest and distant, of future hot air balloons. Al-Mukanna justified his divine nature and his human superiority with this unsubtle theology. God was himself incarnated several times in the form of the prophets, and each prophet was superior to those who preceded him. The preceding incarnation was effectuated in the form of Dawu Muslim, who thus came to be considered superior to the other prophets. He himself constituted the most recent incarnation of the divinity. The caliph had only to surrender. But the incredulous, or impious, caliph sent armies against Al-Mukanna all the same. To recruit the greatest number of followers, he constructed a theology with a seductive ethic of its own. He gave permission to the adherents of his sect to kill those who did not share their beliefs, to take their women and children into captivity, to regard their belongings as fair game. He accorded them an absolute liberty in sexual relations, considered as licit all the acts declared illicit by the Muslim religion, and advised them to take no account of religious prescription or prohibition. Victory would change camp multiple times, but in the end, Baghdad was conquered. In 163 of the Hegira, Al-Mukanna was confined to his castle. To traverse its moats, the attacking army had brought with them 2,000 buffalo hides from India. The Prophet's generals defected. Seeing he had lost, Al-Mukanna employed an artifice that would assure his posthumous prestige by making his followers believe that he had ascended directly to the heavens. In the language of Narshaki, who is said to take his account from Muhammad Dafar, here is the story. "My grandmother was among the women that Mukanna had engaged and kept with him in the castle. She recounted that one day Mukanna invited all the women to drink at his table, as he had the habit of doing. But on this day, he put poison in the wine destined for the women. He had prepared a personal cup for each woman. He said to them, By the time I drink from my cup, you will have to have drunk yours entirely. Then all the women emptied their cups, save for me, who had kept my wine in my throat. And so all the women died, and I laid down next to them, pretending to be dead too. Mukana did not notice. He got up, looked around, finding all the women dead, approached his personal servant, and killed him by severing his head from his body. He had already ordered the oven be kept lit 3 days prior. He approached the oven, undressed, and threw himself in. Smoke emanated from the oven. I approached, but I found no trace of Mukana. There was no one in the castle. The chroniclers differ a little in their manner of recounting this ending. According to one, Al-Mukana threw himself into a pit of quicklime. According to another, it was a vat of vitriol. According to a third, named Alfi, it was a cauldron of mercury. And according to others still, it was a copper foundry or a vat of tar or sugar. Herbelot de Molinville relates the episode in the following manner. Seeing in the end he had no choice but to surrender or perish, he resolved to poison everyone in his circle. One of his concubines, who discovered his plan, hid herself in a corner of the castle to escape this danger, and saw that, after everyone's death, Al-Mukana took their bodies and burned them, after which he threw himself into a vat full of nitric acid that he had prepared. They found nothing of his body but his hair, which remained floating on the water. The subterfuge succeeded. The prophet's followers were persuaded that their master had ascended into the sky for a time and would redescend to earth once more. Khorasan did not see peace again for a long time. This only kept the analysts from denouncing Hakim's fraud unanimously. Later, the reign of the mask appeared as that of an impostor and jester. Long after being conquered, it continues to act upon the imagination. Jorge Luis Borges has devoted a short chapter to Al-Mukana in his Universal History of Infamy. This is an entirely original work, as the cited sources are not known to this author, who in return utilizes none of those known to Sadighi and the other Iranists. At the same time, the events of the life of Al-Mukana found in this essay are peculiar to Borges, who leaves out to the contrary the three episodes well accounted for by the chroniclers: the burning mirrors, the artificial moon, and the suicide in the oven. The Universal History of Infamy includes a bibliography by subject. For Hakim, only two works are mentioned: the enigmatic and inaccessible Romance of the Rose, and the vast, summary, and very accessible History of Persia by Sir Percy Sykes. However, this last work only dedicates a dozen or so lines to the Veiled Prophet, in which the only point in common with the biography composed by Borges remains the allusion to the poem by Moore. 6. The cycle is closed. In France around 1700, the mask is a courtly diversion, but simple happenstance suddenly demonstrated the permanence of the anguish it provokes. It took place in such an unexpected fashion that the description of Saint-Simon, the realist, takes on a fantastical tone, such as one finds in Hoffmann or Edgar Allan Poe. Quote, Lieutenant General Bourignon and Field Marshal Vartigny were killed at the siege of Verrou, two totally singular men of great valor. The previous winter, we had made several very naturalistic wax masks of the court, which we wore under other masks, so that, in unmasking, people were tricked into mistaking the second mask for a face, while the true one, completely different, was below. We heartily amused ourselves with this game. This winter, we wanted to entertain ourselves with it again. To our great surprise, we found each of the masks arranged as we had left them after the carnival, fresh and natural, except those of Boligno and Vortigny, which, conserving their perfect resemblance, had the pallor and dignity of those who have just died. They made an appearance at the ball and inspired such horror that we tried to touch them up with rouge, but the rouge wore off instantly, so the impression could not be altered. It was so extraordinary to me that I felt the need to recount it. I would have kept it secret, too, if only the entire court had not been, like me, a witness, extremely surprised, and several times over, by this strange singularity. In the end, we threw out the two masks. Soon all that remained were the wolves of masked balls and the cardboard heads of carnivals. In 1900, Jean Lorrain spoke once more of the mask with sensibility. In 1948, Georges Barrault spoke of it with science and nostalgia. The cycle is closed. Appendix. Napoleon Bonaparte. An essay entitled The Mask of the Prophet. In the year 160 of the Hegira, Mikati ruled Baghdad. This grand, generous, enlightened, and magnanimous prince saw the Arab Empire prosper in the bosom of peace. Feared and respected by his neighbors, he understood the task of making the sciences flourish and accelerating progress. Yet the tranquility was troubled by Hakim al-Mukanna, who deep in the land of Khorasan began to divide the parties comprising the empire into sectarians. Hakim, of a high stature, masculine and convincing, called himself the envoy of God. He preached a strict morality that pleased the multitude. The equality of rank and fortune were the regular content of his sermons. The people fell in line with his teachings. Hakim had an army. The caliph and his elders felt it necessary to snuff out such a dangerous insurrection at its very beginning. But their troops were beaten several times, and Hakim attained greater superiority each day. A cruel illness brought about by battle fatigue took its toll on the face of the prophet. He was no longer the most handsome of all Arabs. His noble and severe traits, his eyes, big and full of fire, were disfigured. Hakim became blind. This transformation could have lessened the enthusiasm of his adherents, but he had the idea of wearing a silver mask. He appeared before his followers. Hakim had lost nothing of his eloquence. His speech had the same force. He spoke to them and convinced them that he only wore the mask to keep men from being blinded by the light emanating from his face. Now, more than ever, he placed his hopes in the delirium of the people that had exalted him. When the loss of a battle had ruined his affairs, diminished his followers, and weakened their faith, he was besieged in one of his few remaining garrisons. Hakim had to die, or his enemies would come to take hold of his body. He assembled all of his followers and said to them, "Faithful ones, we who God and Muhammad have chosen to restore the empire and reclaim our nature, why should the number of our enemies discourage us? Listen, last night, as you were deep in sleep, I bowed and prayed to God. My Father, you have protected me for so many years. What could my followers or I have done to offend you so that you would abandon us?" A moment later, I heard a voice say to me, "Hakim, those alone who have not abandoned you are your true friends, and they alone are the chosen ones. They will share with you in the riches of your illustrious enemies. Wait for the new moon, dig large pits, and your enemies will go there like flies, distracted by the smoke." The pits were soon dug, and they filled them with coal and placed vats filled with alcohol around the edges. With all that finished, they took a meal in common, drinking the same wine, and all died with the same symptoms. Hakim dragged their bodies into the coal, which consumed them, brought the fire up to the alcohol, and threw himself in. The next day, Caliph's troops advanced, but stopped upon seeing all of the doors open. They entered with caution, but they only found a woman, Hakem's mistress, who had survived him. Such was the end of Hakem, whose followers believed had been taken up to heaven along with his faithful. This example is incredible. How far the mania of illustration can be pushed.
Octavius.
Yeah, I found it hard to focus. There was a distracting birthmark on the side of his face that was undulating in a horrifying way when he was talking.
Well, you know, he didn't name his library the sealed library for no reason.
Ugh. Boy, what is a sealed?
I think it's something that's not opened.
Oh, right. Well, I see.
Like, you know, before you open the letter, it is...
I was confused with the spelling.
Yeah, he does spell his name strangely.
Well, I assumed it was German or something.
Yeah. Or maybe I'm totally wrong. I guess I just assumed it was like, you know, old English poetry.
Right. Sealed.
You read that stuff like, no names are coming to mind, but the words make sense, but they're spelled.
Yeah, they're spelled like you wish that they were spelled when you were learning to spell.
Right. You're like, why is that letter there? Oh, just forget about it. That's how it's spelled.
Yeah, just get on with it. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, he touched on an important topic in the talking show, appearances.
Yeah, yes, it's true. you know, it's good to see that topic come up again.
Yeah, or you know, or in the case of the radio, not see it. But ouch. I'm getting a look. So what's the last mask you wore, Steve?
I'm bad at hats. I think maybe what I favor instead of masks really is more like outrageous facial expressions. Like I was doing that thing a while ago where I would hold my mouth open as wide as possible.
Yeah, I've seen you do that.
Yeah, I can get a whole muffin in there.
Or a ton of Danish pastries.
That's whatever, man. Whatever it is. I can get half an apple.
Yep.
Because they're harder, they don't compress. Yeah, I can't remember what the last mask I would have. Also, you know, here's another thing. I wear glasses so much that I think masks.
That makes
lose mask. A little bit of their charm.
It makes,
you know,
masking very tough.
Yeah, not a lot of masks accommodate the glasses.
No, and when they do, they have fake glasses that don't help so much.
No, yeah, exactly. Or like a Groucho Marx mask or something like that, which is really just a joke about the fact that you wear glasses for real.
Right.
And have a mustache.
Mm-hmm.
We have, on the talking show, of course you can't see, but both Nicholas and I have well-groomed mustaches.
Yeah, with little curls at the end, except when they go downward, not up.
On yours.
Mine.
Yeah, mine's sort of a combo wall. It's a little more butch, maybe. It's sort of a stick straight out like a brush.
Mm-hmm. So I couldn't help it in the beginning, Mr. Sealed, Dr. Sealed probably, said that the essay was by Roger Calois. That ain't an English name.
No, it's a French name.
So that would lead me to believe that Mr. Sealed is, or someone, oh, he said Mr. Stuker.
Translated.
Had
it.
Translated,
yeah.
This. And so in my, after a couple alcoholic beverages, I'm beginning to think about translation as a kind of mask.
Oh.
I don't know. You what,
yeah,
you
yeah, right. There? Like, put on my English mask or whatever. speak this mask or whatever.
Well, I'm not conversant in multiple languages. You are. So I'm wondering how you think about that. I've seen you slip into other languages with people.
I feel like it's kind of like putting on another brain. to get into it. I think figuratively, the mask thing, you know, as a rhetorical device, the mask thing makes sense. But in terms of what it feels like, you just sort of go with it. You know, it's like a bifurcation is presented to you, where you're like, shall I continue in English or will I go on in French? And when you decide to go on in French, then it just happens in French.
Like improvising music?
Like improvising music, yeah. It's like a tunnel. Mm-hmm. And one thing leads to the next thing.
And sometimes someone does something and you realize, I can't go there.
Yeah, you realize that that's beyond you, maybe.
Yeah.
And but you're still sort of in that area. Like, you'll just try and talk slower or use simpler words or what have you.
Or louder, in the case of most Americans.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Yeah, I'd like to think I don't do that, but, you know, being Canadian, it's hard to be loud.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. I vaguely remember some part of that big Proust book where he talks about another language being spoken and this kind of immediate fortress being erected around him. As a kind of like walling off.
Yeah.
That's how I feel when people, you know,
do that to you.
Yeah.
You should try living in a foreign country for a while.
I hope
really?
to be.
Where would you want to live?
Germany beckons.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? Atzo.
I just, you know, I really want one of those brutal Berlin winters. I have never had a brutal winter. And
oh man, you you little
or Mexico dink. Mexico City.
Yeah, I could imagine living in Mexico City actually as well, but
I have a fair deal of Spanish, so the fortress would be penetrable.
Yeah, I feel like that's a very permeable fortress in general, a Spanish fortress.
Mm-hmm.
I'm having pretty good luck studying Spanish right now, I think.
What are you using?
Duolingo. Killing it though.
Great.
Just crushing it. Just that little owl beating it around. But the winter situation is the part that I find, you know, most of the languages that I'm sort of set up to understand are languages of Northern Europe. And I've realized that my aversion to becoming cold has led me away from them. And that Spanish is one thing, but then there's every other language in South Asia, like all the Asian, you know, like I would rather experience weather that didn't come with snow ever. The brutal Berlin winters are awful because they're dark.
Yeah, I met
they're
a guy
not particularly cold.
I met a guy last night who teaches at some college in Hong Kong, and he's looking to move away from Hong Kong. And the two things that he requires are a very good climate and a very strong intellectual life.
What does he mean by good climate?
Warm.
Yeah.
And I would hazard to say that those two things are hard to find together,
you know, at least. I think the thing is that they're hard to find in the English-speaking world, because the English-speaking world is focused so much in places where
it's cold.
It's crappy. Yeah. And I think that's where, you know, I had this amazing experience just like watching the intelligentsia of Mexico City go about their business and realizing they do the same thing that we do here.
They ride Segways and they...
No, no.
They get single-origin coffee.
They are you know, reading books and having in-depth conversations about it and realizing...
Is there a cafe culture?
They were doing all of this in Spanish. And the fortress was built, and I was not invited to the fortress. And I realized that they were having a completely separate art discourse, you know, about the same artists that we would talk about, but having their own discussion, initiating their own publications, doing all their own stuff, and their own rich people were buying this artwork from the gallery. You know, it was exactly what we understand is happening, but just happening in a tongue that meant that it could be understood in, you know, Guatemala. It could be understood in any of the other countries in Latin America, except for Brazil, maybe. But would have a hard time translating to the north part of North America.
Mm-hmm.
And It was nice to know that it would be available to me elsewhere. I would just have to work harder to get it, so to speak.
So what did you do in the face of this fortress?
Well, I just got wasted.
Fair enough.
I was there for an art fair. You know, it was, they would come around every now and again and sling another free bottle of mezcal into our booth.
Wow.
The booth sponsors. It was outrageous.
That sounds better than the Dallas art fair I went to recently.
I would hazard to say that it was better.
Yeah.
And I wasn't at the Dallas one, but I'm just guessing.
At the Dallas one, they rolled around with a cart of extremely nice champagne,
mm-hmm.
and they gave out to everyone who was just, you know, if you were if you could reach them, they gave it to you. And then they came around again a few hours later, and the flutes of champagne were $25.
Oh no!
it was a really weird form of punishment.
Yeah, they would just drop off bottles with these little medicinal looking plastic shot glasses.
Awesome.
With them and be like, here you go.
Hmm.
Yeah, it was outrageous.
That's a culture I could mimic.
Many a time did I contemplate just not getting back on the airplane.
But you have so much here.
It's true. It's true. A family depending on me. A pet.
A cellular phone plan. An art studio.
Yeah. Two art studios. Several cars. All my cars.
Your language.
My native tongue.
Yeah. Here you are. You can walk around without a mask.
Without wearing my Spanish mask.
Yeah.
Just being my hideous self with undulating jellyfish birthmark.
Well.
Good night, everyone.
Gute Nacht.
Schönen Tag.